Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Dead Rock Stars with Mick Wall and Joel McIver.
Welcome, everybody. Here we go to yet another amazing episode of the best podcast in the world devoted to rock music, frankly. And today we are addressing a question which is as old as the hills, perhaps even older. And the question is this: is it Bon or is it Brian? Is it Brian or is it Bon? Now, I present to you my esteemed comrade and dear friend, Mick Wall, who knows more about this than any other three human beings. We are, of course, talking about AC/DC, and today we are talking about their late, very, very, very great singer, Bon Scott. Now, Mick, I'm going to kick off straight away by saying, for you, do you take your AC/DC with Bon or do you take it with Brian?
Well, like all right-thinking people that are never wrong.
Yeah, of course.
Bon Scott, obviously. Now, there would be no AC/DC without Bon Scott.
Was he a better singer than the recent incumbent Brian Johnson?
Yes.
For AC/DC or objectively a better singer? I mean, you know.
Well, neither one of them are what I would call a great singer, but I think they're both great vocalists. You know, rock music is able to accommodate Lou Reed, Ozzy Osbourne, all kinds of different voices and attitudes. And so I think both are fantastic rock vocalists.
Yeah.
I just would always plump for Bon because there's more personality in his voice, whereas Jono, God bless him, is pretty monotone to me.
You see that in a Geordie accent, like, it's pretty monotone.
You sound like an orc from Lord of the Rings.
So look, we've established that we're talking today about the great Bon Scott, Ronald Belford Scott. Have I got that right?
Absolutely.
Scottish gentleman.
He was born in Killamuir. And the Young Brothers were also born in Glasgow, of course, and emigrated to Australia in the 50s.
In the 50s, as a youth.
He was about 8 years old,
I think.
And that's where he got the name Bon Scott, because when he arrived in Fremantle in Perth, although there has always been a huge population of Scottish immigrants in Australia, and unlike the Irish immigrants and other immigrants, they tend to look up to them more than they do others.
The Aussies look up to the jocks.
Yeah, the Scots are seen as being a proud lineage, and the Irish are seen more as wasters. Which is totally not fair. I'm just giving you the cultural
backdrop here. I just wanted to delay things slightly by giving you a quote from R.S. Thomas, the Welsh poet, who said that the English like the Irish but don't respect them. They respect the Scots but they don't like them.
Right.
And they neither like nor respect the Welsh.
Yeah. I'm not with any of that. So he turns up in the school playground and he's got a very broad Scottish accent. 8-year-olds respect no one, and they used to take the piss out of him. And two things came out of that. One, his name, because they used to call him Bonnie Scotland.
That's where it comes from.
Which got quickly shortened to Bon Scott, Bonnie Scott. He also got into loads of scraps and fights, and that was the other part of Bon that was for real.
Right.
That, he was
a scrapper.
He was a scrapper. He was short as well.
A little fella.
So he became a tough guy.
Really tough.
Really tough, yeah.
Okay. Do we have anecdotes from his early years of him being a bit of a person you wouldn't tangle with?
Well, I mean, he ended up in a correctional facility. He was what they used to call a larrabee, which meant he robbed petrol stations, he got into fights, he once beat up and nearly killed a policeman.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he wasn't pissing around.
No, it's all about decisions, isn't it, life? Anyway, look, what Mick hasn't said, because he's a polite gentleman, is that he wrote a book about AC/DC a couple of years ago called something like...
Hell Ain't a Bad Place to Me.
Hell Ain't a Bad Place to Be, which sits proudly on many AC/DC fans' bookshelves. And in fact, you deconstructed in some detail the background of the band, did you not? The Youngs also moving to Australia from Scotland. The whole background, how it all came together, the whole shebang.
No, absolutely, which is, you know, why Bon and the two Young brothers work so well together, because... as anybody that's worked with AC/DC over the years will tell you, I mean, particularly back then when Bon was alive, Malcolm was alive, when they were still building empires.
Yeah.
It was a clan, you know.
Nice people, would you say, Mick?
Well, it was a clan.
No,
so,
that's not what I said.
Well, I'm trying to answer your question. If you'll fucking let me, I'll tell you what I mean.
I'm just trying to wind you up. It's working.
They were a clan, and that means you are either in or you're nowhere.
Or you are out.
Well, you didn't.
Knocked out.
You didn't exist. I mean, you weren't. There was no out. You're either part of the Brotherhood, or you're just, you know, completely dispensable, of no consequence whatsoever. What happens to you?
Was this a consequence of a tough background and a tough life? You know, you had to know who your friends were, right?
Definitely. And also, these days, Australia is a, you know, if you're going to start a new life, it's a pretty wonderful place to go and do that. Mm. Back in the 50s, when they were doing what was known as the 10 quid deal in this country, they were shipping out people that couldn't find jobs, that had really tough, rough lives. And the Scots and the Youngs were like that. You know, the Youngs were a huge family. There were about eight of them. Mm. And they lived in what were known as the Schemes in Glasgow. Mm. I went up and visited the Schemes in the modern sense. And it was, I met one guy who was amazing. He lived next door to them. Back in those days, he said, with the dockyards and the mines, where they lived, the air was black with soot, with grime, with chimney smoke. And he said it was positively satanic, which made me laugh because, of course, it fits very nicely into
Doesn't
the narrative.
It just? Yeah.
But they were very, very tough guys, the Youngs. I mean, Bon was not tall, but the Youngs were even shorter than Bon.
They were really weeny, weren't they?
I am not a tall man, but I remember interviewing Angus
once.
Don't
say that. 4'9" is not short.
in a hotel room. And it was like interviewing a child. His little feet wouldn't touch the ground. You know, he's sitting in an armchair with his feet sticking out.
There's a lot of short men in rock.
But tough as shit. I mean, one guy you didn't mess with was Malcolm. Malcolm was tough. I mean, beat the shit out of you. The only guy Malcolm would never mess with was Bon.
Mm.
Bon was the real deal. I mean, having said this, very like Phil Lynott, you know, okay, here's this tough guy because he comes from a very underprivileged background and had to fight his way from nothing. But at the same time, you know, Bon was very erudite. Bon was very well-read. Mm. Bon knew wine. Bon knew poetry. People find this hard to believe, but, you know, you've only got to look at the group he was in before AC/DC, who were called Fraternity, and listen to some of their songs on YouTube to see this complete 180-degree different kind of Bon, very soulful, meaningful, acoustic, trippy.
Did you meet the dude?
Bon Scott. Yeah. I did meet Bon Scott, yeah, a few times.
Tell us, please.
Well, when I met him, Highway to Hell was out and had done reasonably well for them in Britain, but they'd been doing reasonably well in Britain for a while. But Highway was now making a big difference in America. They were still opening for bands.
When was Highway, 77, 78?
79.
Oh.
So they were still opening for bands in America. I mean, Highway was sort of like their sixth album or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And there'd been stars in Australia since 74, but their fame in Australia was now waning.
Yeah.
So Highway really saved their skin. It was a last chance saloon scenario in terms of whether they would be taken seriously as an international rock band.
Yeah.
Or whether they would become this kind of a midnight oil, you know, one of these bands from Australia for the rest of their
Cold
days.
Chisel.
Exactly. You know,
not
that there's anything wrong with those guys, but
no.
Their success never translated internationally over any period.
Yeah.
So he was still very down to earth. And there's no way to tell this story properly without also explaining that I met Bon at his heroin dealer's flat.
Wow.
His heroin dealer was a lady named Silver, who had been the great love of Bon's life back in Australia, but who moved in what were considered in rock circles in the 70s, very aristocratic social circles. She lived at Ron Wood's of the Rolling Stones place for a long time and hung out with that end of the world. This is the 70s, so we're talking about heroin chic.
Yes.
People think, imagine crack pipes and ghettos. That's not what we're talking about when you talk about the Stones and that end of the world. But Bon was madly in love with her, had written many songs about her on previous AC/DC albums.
Yeah.
And I was a partner in a rock PR firm called Heavy Publicity. I was 20, 21, and we did Thin Lizzy, Black Sabbath. I've kind of told this story before, but again, we go back to the late 70s, and in those days, everybody carried cocaine.
Yeah.
Everybody smoked pot. Everybody drank brandy in the middle of the day. You know, I mean, it was just this. We were in the rock business. We didn't get in the rock business because we disapproved of that kind of behaviour. You know, there was no AIDS. In fact, not even really any VD. There were rock and roll private doctors. You could cure anything except heroin addiction. And even that, with a bottle of Jack Daniels and 3 grams of coke, you could deal with just by, you know, toughing it out for 3 days. I mean, that was bullshit, but that's what we believed.
It's a bit different now, isn't it?
Well, we're more in possession of the facts, and we have alternatives.
Yeah.
You know, we have rehabs and better knowledge and the internet and all that stuff. But back then it was who you know.
Yeah.
So her name was Silver, and she lived in Gloucester Road. Other people bought from her. Chris Squire of Yes, who we'll cover in another episode one
great
day.
Man.
She lived on like the third floor, and it was always a schlep having to go up the steps to her tiny flat up there. So she used to lower the drugs on a clothesline down to Chris Squire, and he'd sit there in his car with the sunroof and get it.
What was she dealing, smack?
Oh, you name it. But that was the main thing by 79.
I suppose if you bought the right drugs up there, you come down with a spring in your step, so it'd be all right.
Yeah, or just face first.
Fall down the fucking steps. Yeah.
I remember she had this mirror, which she'd bought at Kensington Market, now sadly gone. But it had like 7 grooves in the mirror and a big sort of space here where you'd put the big powder.
Yeah.
So what you did was, instead of the effort of chopping this powder into lines,
it's hard work.
You just push the powder over the grooves and it just fell into neat lines.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so as I walked in, Bon, who is, you know, skinny, tough guy with tattoos, and it was, oh, Mick, this is Bon, Bon, this is Mick. I didn't twig he was the singer of AC/DC because they weren't that big a deal at the time.
Yeah.
And he just went, oh, hello, mate, do you want some of this? And I went, oh, yeah, great, cheers. And he said, do you want a cup of tea? And I went, yeah, yeah, great.
Why not?
So we all sat around, had a cup of tea, and and it was very pleasant.
And he was an erudite chap.
He was totally
nice
erudite.
To be with.
One of the features of Bon in his life, particularly touring with AC/DC, he didn't hang out with them. He was considerably older. His nickname in the band was the Old Man.
How much older was he?
Well, if they were 22, he was like 29.
Yeah, okay. Well, was it end of your 20s? That's quite a big
deal. It was early 30s when he died. But really, it was the cultural difference. I mean, Angus never drank or took a drug in his life. Malcolm loved his booze and his smoke and his toot and all the rest of it, but mainly the booze, you know, and a man's man. And that was all good. But I think once you get to your late 20s, early 30s, I know in my life there was a moment where I just didn't want to hang out with 22-year-old headbangers anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
I actually did read books. I actually did know the difference between a Bordeaux and
a Merlot.
I was going to say a Liebfraumilch.
Okay, yeah, 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 yeah.
So not only did he not hang out with them, not only did he live in a separate place to them, because they would share houses in London, on the road, he quite often travelled with the support band. So who were they opening for? Probably Aerosmith or someone like that in the 78 or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Dave Menichetti from Y&T, they were like the opening band on the bill. And he told me he had a great memory of, they'd just finished their set, this huge outdoor in Normo Dome in the summer in America, you know.
Yeah.
And next one were AC/DC for 45 minutes, and then it would be Aerosmith or whoever for, you know, an hour and a half. And they were panicking because, no Bon. Where's Bon? When did you last see him? I don't know, last night. You know, what was he doing? And literally with 5 minutes to go before on stage, and they're at some desert place in Arizona or something, they see this cloud of dust coming at speed towards the stadium. And it's literally two trucks, open back trucks, Mexicans, and it's all, hey, wala, hola, hey, wala, wala. And here's Bon on the back of the truck with a bottle in each hand, no shirt. And they're going, Bon, where have you been? Where have you gone? Come on, mate, let's fucking do the show.
Straight on.
Straight on.
Didn't do his vocal warm ups.
No, his vocal warm ups would gargle Jack Daniels. And,
bloody hell, man.
I mean, Ian Jeffrey, the tour manager, wonderful guy who, him and Bon used to share a room.
Yeah.
And he said, I don't know why they put beds in our room, because we didn't sleep for about 3 years. He just said, can you imagine sharing a room with Bon Scott in AC/DC?
Sorry, Mick. So we quite often in these podcasts jump to the sort of the sad years without spending the time I would like to spend on the big, happy, good mental times. Was his thing booze or coke or both?
Everything.
So was he taking smack at this point?
Everything. Bloody when hell. He was in fraternity, similar to AC/DC, if you know the AC/DC story, they came to London.
Yeah.
They were big in Australia. In order to make it in the UK, they came and all lived, like Australians do, came and all lived in a big house in Earl's Court.
Yeah, of course, yeah. Straight with Mike. That hemisphere is fucked.
What's less well known is that just 3 years before, Bon had done exactly the same thing with fraternity. Mm. They lived in Norwood or somewhere like that.
Yeah.
And again, you know, typical squat hippie house. But fraternity, from the name, you can tell they were hippie band. I mean, right. Bon would play flute. I mean, for goodness sake,
that
you know.
That's mad, isn't it?
But his nickname in the group was Road Test Ronnie. Because any drug that came in the house, if they were a little bit iffy, Bon would take it.
Yeah.
Again, you've got to remember, no internet, all right?
No.
So what you relied on with your dealers was whatever happened to come their way. I mean, in this country these days, I do not take drugs, haven't done for many years. But these days, most of the weed in this country is made in this country. It's done by people that have marijuana farms under hydroponic lights, and they make incredibly strong weed. Back in the late 70s, none of that went on. It was always imported.
Afghan so, sort of stuff.
Absolutely. You get some guy coming in going, oh, I've got a nice bit of Rocky Moroccan. I've got a nice bit of Afghani. Yeah, obviously.
And then, was he quite camp then?
He was this guy, yeah. He it was just this one guy who used to service everybody in London.
He serviced everyone?
He did.
Mick, what the hell are you talking about?
Oh, I remember that one of my, that I read about once, was called... I've got some nice Nepalese temple ball. You're going to love it. You see, it's black, and the white streaks, that's opium. And everybody go, opium.
Oh, man, that's so exotic.
Yeah. But at the same time, they'd come in with powders and pills and go, nah, this was made by a German scientist in 74, but it got stolen from his laboratory. So today what I've got, and this is the stuff that Hendrix took when he made Electric Ladyland. I mean, you have these conversations.
Great days.
And people
days.
Would go, wow, so... Okay, but of course, and this sometimes resulted in death. I mean, Lemmy has great stories of bikers turning up with all kinds of chemical compounds that would actually kill you or make your hair fall out.
He had this story, didn't he, about how a friend of his died in his arms after taking a drug that was laced with rat poison.
Wow.
If you recall that story. Wow. It's either in my book or your book or something.
Was it Moroccan rat poison or...?
Yeah, only the best.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
The bloke literally died, said, I'm going to die, and he did die. So it was all awful.
People did die, you know, so, I mean...
Which makes Ronnie the road test.
Road test Ronnie.
A bit of a...
So, and lunatic, but Australians lunatic in London, can you imagine? So lunatics from
I'll
all over...
I'll try it, mate.
Yeah,
stick it up me nose.
Yeah, crazy Phil was here. He's from that squat in Ladbroke Grove. Yeah, you guys are lightweights. You won't like this. Give it a road test, Ronnie. Here, Ronnie, what do you reckon? Fuck that. Give it a me, mate. Way. And if Ronnie was still alive the next day, they'd all get stuck
in. They'd all pile in.
Dead rock stars. For those who have rocked, we salute you.
So this is Bon, okay? And don't forget he'd been married.
We say Bon.
By the time he joins AC/DC, he's more or less given up on the idea of ever making it. He just had a horrendous motorcycle accident which nearly killed him, broke nearly every bone in his body, broke his jaw, lost all his teeth.
Jeez.
When he met AC/DC, he was a guy sweeping up studios and he met them because he was driving them around while they were doing a couple of club gigs in the area.
When was that? When did he join AC/DC?
I think officially he joined them in late 73, early 74. There was a single with another vocalist called...
Oh, Dave Evans.
Dave Evans.
Right. He's still around, isn't he? He's doing stuff.
He is, yeah. I interviewed him for the book. But Bon, well, here's the point, is that AC/DC always had that kind of Chuck Berry, Rolling Stones.
Yeah.
You know, the young brothers with their other brother, older brother George, perfected that formula. But here's what took it out of that orbit into something much more interesting.
Yeah.
Bon Scott.
Well, that and Malcolm Young's picking hand, which was just insane.
Oh no, absolutely. Yeah, but let's put another vocalist in the band. Let's put Udo Dirkschneider in the band.
Where'd you come up with that name?
Well, I'm trying to think of a generic sort of rock.
Let's
put the bloke from Crocus in there. Let's put Paul Di'Anno in there. What are you actually going to have? You're going to have a chugging rock band?
You're
really,
absolutely right. I'm just laughing at the thought of it.
Who are tied to... Well, Udo Dirkschneider, because except we're complete AC/DC fans.
He loves AC/DC.
And modelled their whole... I love AC/DC.
Yeah, especially Bon Scott. He's a big influence on me.
He's a big... You know, I sing more like Jeannot, because I don't really sing, you know, but I also am French. I don't know if you know that Dirk is French.
Become French!
I can be Jim.
Fight in your general direction.
Would you like a wafer of thin meat?
Oh, dear.
Right, so Bond comes
the secret sauce.
It's a long way to the top if you want to rock and roll.
Right.
Read those lyrics.
Yeah.
That is the work of a lyrical fucking genius.
Right.
Touch Too Much. Remember how that begins?
No.
It was one of those nights where you turn out the lights and everything comes into view. Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah, I mean,
that's poetry. You turn out the lights and now you can see better. I love that.
That's deep. These are lyrics that are, as you said, about Lemmy and Ace of Spades, sort of like a 17th century sort of bawdy street
absolutely
sort of, anthem, you know. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
He was like the Rabbi Burns of rock.
Hey.
He was a real street poet, a real street guy. I mean, the endless tales of him fighting and brawling and his drug exploits, his women exploits... All of that stuff is in his songs.
Yeah.
But there is other stuff. I mean, for instance, I mean, this is one of the reasons why I prefer that era. If you listen to a track like What's Next to the Moon.
Yeah.
I mean, think about that. What is next to the moon? Would Jono ever go, What's next to the moon? Bloody hell, man, you're bloody next to the fucking moon. I mean... What's next to the moon? I love that. That's a philosophical question.
That's lyrical. You appear to be implying that there's a radical difference between the vocal styles of Bon and Brian.
Oh, fuck yeah. Bon could do a song like Ride On.
I would edge more towards there's a slight difference between their vocal styles.
No.
I'm sure radically different.
No, you're completely wrong.
Am I completely wrong?
Completely wrong.
It's the right opinion, but it's the wrong one.
No.
All right, let me present, if you will, an alternative viewpoint.
Yeah, go on then.
Let me put this to you.
Yeah, I put it to me.
For a certain... Demographic of AC/DC fans.
Oh, demographic.
For a certain demographic of AC/DC.
I hate that word. There were no such thing as demographics when Bond was in the band. So there's a comparison straight away.
For a certain bunch of people who loved AC/DC, right, the transition, the segue, if you will, between the Bond era and the Brian era was actually smoother than most people thought because the music wasn't radically different. If anything, it had that nice Mutt Lange sheen.
The music was
identical. The vocals weren't drastically different either. They were different, but they weren't drastically different. So I put it to you... that some people don't care about my opening question, do you like your AC with Bon or Brian? Because they just listen to it, it's all roughly the same.
No, I disagree. I think every AC/DC fan I've ever met asks you that question. And it's a bit like Ozzy and Dio. It defines the generation. So, for instance, you being the next generation down from me, your AC/DC, I would contend, is the Jono AC/DC.
You would contend correctly.
Lots of other writers I know of your age... absolutely cannot understand why anybody gives a stuff about the Ozzy era of Sabbath. It's Dio, because Dio had the better voice. I would contend Ozzy was the more unique vocalist, but definitely Dio had the superior voice.
Yeah.
Jono, you know, what are we talking, one good album?
Depends on your point of view. I mean...
No, one good album.
Definitely
Back in Black, which was
not
essentially...
Not just a good album. I mean, an insanely huge landmark album.
All right. Yeah. Next album, for those about to rock, one good track.
Yeah.
Next album after that, no good tracks. Next album after that, no good tracks. Next album after that, who made who?
But there were stinkers, were there not, in the Bond era too?
I don't know if there were, actually, Joel. Can you name one?
I would leave that to you as the expert.
I can't think of any.
Yeah, okay.
I honestly can't. And each album is somewhat different. And God bless Jono, he's done a great job. But they had found the formula. After Back in Black, the fact that they fired Mutt Lange, the fact that they fired their management, was all down to Malcolm Young. And this is another story we'll get into when we do an episode on Malcolm.
Yeah.
But it was all down to Malcolm, who was the generalissimo of the band, deciding that we didn't need those people anymore. We've cracked it. We know what to do. And then they went straight in to make some of the most mediocre albums of their entire career.
They did, man.
You can't name a Bon Scott album that was mediocre.
Okay, that's fine. We need to spend a little bit of time talking about his demise because there is a lot of material to cover there. In your book, you dug, I think, pretty deeper than most historians have when it came to the circumstances of his death in, I want to say, February 1980?
February 1980, yeah.
Okay, this is where I peripherally come into the story. And very, very tangentially, it's because I knew a woman called Maggie Montalbano, who is now no longer with us, but she was a friend of Alistair Kinnear, who was the last person to see Bon alive.
Yep.
Right. So would you like to run us through that and tell us why historians have disagreed about various aspects of his death?
If we're going to be real for a moment, most rock and metal journalists don't want the truth, don't know the truth, don't want to tell the truth. And Bon was, that horrible word, an icon. So they like to believe that he'd been on the piss and his good mate Alistair had left him in the car to sleep it off, and that maybe Bon died of asphyxiation, got sick or whatever, which he may have technically died of asphyxiation. And they always go on about the coroner's report. Mm. Okay, well, I spoke to a coroner for my book and he told me categorically, who was active in those days, it's the same now, but particularly in 1980, no computer records, nothing, right?
Yep, yep.
Bon was not a famous rock star. You know, if that had been Mick Jagger lying on the slab, or more to the point, say, Keith Richards, more would have been done in this respect, okay?
Yeah.
But here's a nobody, some Australian bloke with tattoos. He said the only toxicology report that you did in those days was purely on alcohol levels.
Yep.
You didn't test to see if there were drugs in there. Poor fucker's dead. What, now we're going to kill him twice by prosecuting him posthumously, which A, you can't do anyway, and B, who gives a shit? It's not a famous
sort of
person.
Time and money that the medical people didn't spend.
It's time and money. It's just another long-haired fool with tattoos who's dead.
Yeah.
He drank shitloads that night because Bon drank shitloads every night. But what they never go into, because they just don't want to go there, or in fairness to them, they don't have the experience I have. I was there. I was actually there in those days with these same people. And the night of his death, Bon had gone to visit Silver.
Yep.
Bought a shitload of heroin, tried to persuade her. It was like a Monday night or something. I mean, Monday night in London in 1980. Kill me now.
In February.
Yeah. Wanted her to come out with him. Coming out, there was a group on at the Music Machine. The group at the Music Machine were managed by Peter Perrett's wife, Peter Perrett of The Only Ones, and a fabulously famous junkie, as was his wife.
Yeah.
And Silver won't go out. Silver's was never a boozer. Silver, it was always smack.
Yeah.
And she's like, oh, I ain't going to that porn Monday. It was at the Music Machine, which is now the Camden whatever. Monday night at the Music Machine to see a band you've never heard of. You know what? I'm just going to stay here, take my heroin and enjoy myself.
Just the heroin for me, thanks.
She goes, oh, but Alistair might go out with you. He didn't know Alistair. Mm. Alistair's just another druggy guy scoring at Silver's. Alistair will probably go out with you. Mm, okay, you know. So they go out. And he drinks a shitload, because that's what he did. I mean, I was probably at the Music Machine two nights before that with Brian Robertson from Thin Lizzy.
Yeah, right.
And he would order quadruple tequilas, just as a matter of course. Well, Bon was one of those guys.
Like, not just, you know, you and I might go out and drink five pints and feel mildly befuddled.
No.
A proper...
proper drink, yeah.
Tons and tons of spirits.
Because he also had a shitload of coke on him, and he had smack. Yeah. Now, if you know anything about heroin, and if you were into that stuff any time, but especially in those days, the golden rule was you don't mix it with booze.
Because
it kills you. You know, the two do not
it's
combine.
Too much for the body to handle.
They don't combine. It's like oil and water. You will either puke or you will just fall unconscious and puke. Mm. Once they go, they can't wake up. So anyway, this all goes on. They leave the Music Machine. Alistair's not drinking. He's a druggie. And they're driving back and Bon is out. He's gone. Alistair cannot wake him.
Mm.
And what never gets spoken about is what happens next. Alistair drives Bon back to Bon's flat.
In whose car?
Victoria. In his own car.
Alistair's own car.
Yeah, not back to Alistair's place and lets him sleep it off. He takes Bon home. But Bon lives on like the third or fourth floor and he cannot drag him up the stairs because the man is gone. It's not like, oh, I'm drunk. I love you.
He's completely out. Yeah.
He's a dead body, essentially.
Breathing.
Yes.
Right.
So Alistair goes to a phone box and rings Silver and says, I don't want to fucking do. I can't get him out of the car. I'm at his house. I can't get up the stairs on my own. What do I do? I mean, it's 2 a.m. And she goes, oh, let him sleep it off.
Mm.
So he's like, oh, fuck. So he drives home to his place.
Do we know if he put Bon in the recovery position or anything like that?
No.
No, but do we know it? Or
we know it.
We know that
How do you put someone in a recovery in a car seat?
I imagine if I had to do it, I would wind the seat down so it was horizontal and then flip him on his side. Okay. I'm not saying I would if I was pissed off my face and this was, I couldn't be bothered. I'm just saying.
He wasn't pissed. He was smacked out of his head.
Yeah, okay.
And he was terrified that the law would become involved. Hmm. There's one thing junkies care about more than heroin. It's being caught taking heroin by police.
Crikey.
So he drives back to his place in South London, bloody miles away, freezing night in February. Born on the coldest night of the year would be in a cut-off T-shirt, you know, with bare arms and, you know, be lucky if he had a jacket. And Alistair, being, what a surprise, an irresponsible junkie who doesn't give a shit, left him there. Later, he said he left a note or, you know, ring the doorbell.
Yeah.
He leaves Bond outside a building Bond's never been to before in his life, in a car he's never been in before in his life, and he's gone. Alistair goes up to bed, sleeps till
around the clock,
till like four the next afternoon.
Yeah.
Has his breakfast, cup of tea, bit more smack, comes downstairs to go out somewhere. Fuck me! The bloke, he's still in the car! Only now he's stiff as a board. And that's how Bond Scott died. And like a lot of these deaths, it gets kind of swept under the carpet. It's one of those things where, you know, oh, Zeppelin broke up because Bonham died. No, they didn't. Yeah. You know, Bond got drunk. And no, that really doesn't tell the story.
What are the theories? I've read that some people thought that Alistair Kinnear did not, in fact, exist. He did subsequently vanish a few years later, which
he
is
actually,
neither here nor there, actually.
He actually went to live on a houseboat, and then he was out doing, had a, like a fishing thing in the Mediterranean.
Yeah, in Spain, and that's where he vanished on some sort of trip.
Right.
About 10 years ago, I think, maybe more. But the circumstances of Bond's death, as I recall from your book and other things that I've read, tell me if this is wrong. Is your point that heroin was involved, but a lot of other people did not think that was the case?
Because, oh, absolutely.
Because heroin would make you die if you drank.
Tell me any other books you've read before my book that didn't say he died of drinking too much.
Yeah, that's what it's been said. I mean, like Bonham, right? Drank too much, aspirated his own vomit and died.
Yeah, yeah.
So why, I mean, God, I don't know if this really matters even. Why is it so important that we get those facts straight?
Well, why is it important you get facts straight?
No, particular facts, given that he's dead 30 years. You know, I'm not trying to be controversial. I'm just saying, why is it important that we get this particular element straight? Did he take heroin? Did he not take heroin?
Well, this is a philosophical question, Joel.
I
might as well say to you, why is it important we do this podcast? Do you want to hear the truth or do you want me to spout the bullshit?
I like it. All right, good.
That's why it's important we get the facts, mate, because you either want to hear the truth or you want to have a wank over the bullshit. You know, if you want to believe in Santa Claus, that's entirely up to you, but I fucking don't.
Good man.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This is the Dead Rock Stars podcast.
What was the impact then on AC/DC?
Well, AC/DC, in the shape of the Young Brothers,
yeah,
it has always been an unstoppable machine. I mean, look at what happened after Jono went. They got Axl Rose in. You know, they don't care. They keep going.
What did you think of that, by the way, that move?
Axl Rose?
Yeah.
I thought it was genius.
Yeah, me too.
I thought it was totally inspired.
Off the wall, you know. Like,
Axel,
you know,
well, yeah. You say off the wall, but Axel loved AC/DC.
Yeah, yeah.
They covered Rose Tattoo on their very first record, Guns N' Roses.
Yeah,
nice,
sure.
Nice Boys Don't Play Rock and Roll. Axel and Izzy loved those Australian bands.
Yeah, yeah.
Guns N' Roses always did Whole Lot of Rosie. The first time they played in London at the Marquee, they did Whole Lot of Rosie.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. This is not a new thing. And
just to me.
well, to you and many people. I mean, I've mentioned this. I've done loads of interviews about this.
Yeah, yeah.
And whenever I mention it, people go, did they?
Is that right?
Really?
Can you prove this?
Good Lord. And then I go, have you heard Axel's voice? You know,
it's always a baby.
Also, John O wears a hat. You know why, by the way, you know why John O wears the flat cap, right?
No, why?
Keep the sweat out of his eyes.
Get away. I like it.
And you know why Axel always has a big collection of hats, don't you?
No, I don't.
Keep the sweat out of his eyes.
This is unbelievable. You hear it here first. All right, look. Malcolm, the leader of the band, kept pushing forward. Angus went along with him. Cliff and was it Phil Rudd playing drums at the time or not yet?
No. When you say not yet, that's a bizarre thing. Phil was always the drummer from the just after when Bond... No, leave that in here. It's great.
Make me sound right.
No, don't Ian.
So the band kept going, driven along by...
The band kept going, they driven along by Axel.
I know, I was going to say that.
No, leave it all in, Ian.
Edit out.
Ian, the mistakes are what make it.
They're all mistakes.
You're wasting time. They auditioned loads of singers. Gary Holton from the Heavy Metal Kids, Jimmy Barnes from Cold Chisel.
Jimmy Barnes.
The guy that had been the singer in the Easy Beats, whose name I could... Stevie. Yeah, edit that bit out. and eventually settled on Brian Johnson.
From Geordie. What band was Geordie, for those who don't know?
Poor man's AC/DC. I mean, they were in the glam rock era. Can you imagine Jono in platform, silver platforms and Lame. They were really good. They had a couple of singles.
Yeah.
There was one called You Can't Do That. You can't do that! You can't do that! You can't do that!
Make it sound terrible, but I never want to hear it.
No, it's a great track. Look for it on YouTube.
Okay.
Jono had met Bond. There's a famous story where the two of them had met. I can't remember now. You have to buy the book.
Buy the book, read it there.
Yeah, and I can't remember. But here is my point. They auditioned a lot of vocalists that arguably would have brought as much to the band as Bon Scott did. But they plumped for Brian Johnson, A, because he had a great voice to carry on with, but B, they figured he would assimilate better. Shall we put it that way?
I like it.
He'd do what he was fucking told.
Oh, and did he subsequently do what he was told?
Well, he was there for another 30 years. I think it's fair to assume he didn't challenge Malcolm in any way.
And as we know, their next album was their biggest and their best.
It was, and sweet irony, of course, it was the album that should have made Bon Scott the biggest rock star in the world.
Had he been involved in Back in Black, actually?
Yes, he had.
In what way?
Well, Bon was an inveterate note taker and was always coming up with ideas for lyrics. He kept notebooks. So it wasn't like one of these guys that goes into the studio and writes lyrics for the album. He always had a bunch of stuff he would draw on. He'd be in there going, flicking through the book, seeing what he had, an idea. And their tour manager told me that the day after he died, I mean, he went to Bond's flat to, as it were, clean it up. And he collected all the notebooks and everything. Mm. And I don't think it's a case of, well, Bond wrote a whole lyric to this or a whole lyric to that. But there were lots of lyrical ideas and lines that I've been told were absolutely used on Back in Black.
Okay.
And as I put it in the book, I'm not trying to go on about the book, but I can't think of a better way of putting it. You know, with Bon Scott, you know, there were lots of double entendres in AC/DC. With Jono, we're into the world of single entendres. You know, no, we're no longer what's next to the moon. We're sink the pink.
Oh, see, I tuned
balls up. To the wall.
Did you enjoy?
Oh no, that was except, wasn't it?
Might as well have been
interchangeable.
Did you enjoy all this stuff?
What stuff?
This single entendre Jono era stuff.
Back in Black, no one with a pulse can deny what an absolutely fantastic record that was. But their only good album with Jono, you know.
Yeah.
For those about to rock, one good track, the title track, and that itself very formulaic at that point. The next two or three albums are worst in their entire catalogue. And even when they work with Rick Rubin, you know, unlike Sabbath.
Ballbreaker.
Yeah, unlike Sabbath, unlike the Chili Peppers, unlike everybody else that's ever worked with Rick Rubin.
Yeah. He failed to execute a sort of rebirth.
It was like going to the hairdressers and saying, I want you to give me an Elvis Presley. And then halfway through going, fuck, what are you doing to my fucking hair? I like it long down the side with a blonde streak. You know, that was Malcolm. It was Malcolm's way or the highway.
I put it to you that the mid to late 80s onward did not suit AC/DC. They were not from that era. Their albums didn't sit well in that era with the production, the expectation that people had of rock music.
Well, Aerosmith did okay.
They sounded nothing like those terrible AC/DC albums that we're talking about. Blow Up Your Video and all that bollocks.
Here's the thing. I don't think you can blame the era for making a shit record.
No, but no, you're right. But what I meant by that is that...
I think if Highway to Hell...
The day, don't they, partly dictate whether an album sounds good or not.
These are timeless records. If Led Zeppelin 2 had come out in 1989, it would have been a multi-platinum worldwide.
I only mean, sorry, the bad AC/DC albums that we're talking about.
Well, bad albums are bad albums at any time. If those bad albums had come out in 76, they would have been dead.
Well, okay, that was the point I wanted to make, really. Would the songs have sounded better 10 years before?
No, they're just shit songs, Joel. They were shit in the 80s.
I'm trying to be nice
to shit now.
I'm trying to help them out.
You're a young man who grew up listening to that bollocks, Fly on the Wall and all that bullshit.
Cacking it, really.
Fucking wipe your ass on it, mate.
In the era of Metallica and big heavy bands like that,
it wasn't
stand
up, fucking era. It was the shit songs, you know? Metallica worshipped AC/DC, but which AC/DC did they worship?
All right.
Bon Scott.
Okay.
And Back in Black.
What about Black Ice? Was that a return to form?
No, it was rubbish.
Better than the previous ones?
Pretty low bar.
And what was the last one? Rock or Bust?
What an inspirational title that
is. Desperate, isn't it? I don't know. I've always tried to like AC/DC post Back in Black. I just find myself fucking falling asleep.
It's because it's shit, Joel.
Yeah, I know. And then Back in Black. Thank God for Back in Black, because you can spend that all day, every day, and it's just amazing.
Well, that's the point. I mean, and that is the point. You know, when you say, okay, they only made... Well, when I say, rather, they only made one great album.
Mm.
What an album. And also, that's one more great album than 90% of every rock band has ever made.
Would it have been as good with Bon?
Oh, fuck yeah. Better.
Okay, so it's not simply because it came at that pivotal turning point in the band's history that it was so amazing. Of itself, it was an incredible.
Now, the timing is important in terms of its commercial success. But in terms of it being a sonic masterpiece, if that came out today, it would be the same. If it came out in 75, it would have been the same. You know, it's not all down to timing and history. You know, when it comes to the classic albums of all time, Appetite for Destruction would have been as amazing in 73, more so arguably.
Yeah.
If it came out today, like that would ever happen in this weak-willied rock world we live in.
Weak-willied.
You know, these are
sounds like a producer.
These are classic albums.
It's funny, you know, I totally hear you and understand you, but I tend to take a different view, which is that art is embedded in its time and that you can't necessarily translate it easily, and that sometimes things which are great in one era just
aren't. Why are we still listening to it then?
Because certain albums do transcend that, I'll agree with you.
Well, that's what I'm talking about.
That's what I'm talking about.
I just said more than 90%, right?
All right, Mick.
So the Beatles are no good because we're not in the 60s anymore.
The Beatles. All right, listen up. We normally end these things, do we not? He said, ignoring him, moving on. By giving marks out of 5 for various criteria, which we apply to the recently or latterly deceased subject under discussion. Now, this is a good one about Bon, right? How many marks out of 5, Mick, would you give Bon Scott for his star quality, bearing in mind he didn't dress like fucking Bowie and he didn't prance around like Freddie? He was the working man's rock star, you know what I mean?
One of the great things about AC/DC was they didn't have a video, didn't have a single, and mainly in Bond's career, apart from in Britain and Australia, they opened for huge bands like Aerosmith and Ted Nugent.
Mm-hmm.
And they often began the night with audiences that had no idea who they were.
Yeah.
And by the end of that night, that audience would be on its feet.
Bloody knew
stamping.
Where they were.
And that was down to the brilliance of the band, but in terms of charisma and excitement and complete undeniability, that was Bon Scott and Angus Young.
Beautifully put.
So I would say 5 stars.
Five by five. What about Bon's influence, bearing in mind We are still talking about him, but AC/DC became commercially much bigger with Brian than they had been with him.
Well, the commercial thing's interesting. I think it doesn't matter anymore because we have all this music at our fingertips.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter whether it's 1980 or 71. You know, it's the same with Zeppelin. I would say Bond's influence, I wouldn't give it 5 because I don't see enough people following in his footsteps.
Right.
There aren't enough storytellers. There aren't enough real deal larrikins that have the personality and the talent to do what Bond did.
Yeah.
I'd probably say 3.
All right, I like that. Taste for excess.
5.
Well, he did die of it.
No, the man lived it.
Mm.
He lived it long before he died of it.
All right.
He was on, may I say, a highway to hell.
Our final criterion is whether we deserve to give him high marks for death as a career move. He's young. He had more to give, did he not? It's hard, isn't
it? In terms... Oh, boy, it really is hard because obviously the next AC/DC album goes on to become one of the biggest selling records
Without
of all time.
Him, yeah.
Yeah, although I would argue that I don't think Bond's death had any direct influence on that. It was a nice press story, Back in Black, dedicated to Bond. It was a nice press story. But at the end of the day, every band, every day of the week, puts out nice press stories. It was the album that made it, and whatever way you slice it, it was made without Bond. So death as a career move. I'm going to say 3.
All right. So his greatness contained in a particular period of history, which we're still talking about,
right?
And everyone will for a long, long time to come. Moving swiftly on to the rock star you're going to hear about next time. While Bond and our next dead rock star could both be considered street poets, our next artist would definitely consider himself to be a proper poet.
Whilst Bond was the life and the soul of the party, it's not something our next dead rock star has ever been accused of.
Indeed. And what's more, in 1974, the pre-Bon Scott AC/DC supported our next dead rock star on his Australian tour.
And while Bond famously wrote about Rosie, our next dead rock star wrote about Suzanne, Caroline, Lisa and Sally.
And if that's not enough for you, while Bond saw Venus with arms, our next dead rock star saw her in fur. You can infer everything you like.
No!
Well, everyone, that's it. Thank you very much indeed for tuning in. This has been a 7 Digital production, and we will be back next week. Or should I say, we will be back in black next week. Thank you very much. Bye.
Bye now, you Johnny. Goodbye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Mother's Day is just around the corner, and it's time to pamper the special moms in your life. And what better way than with Osea's limited edition skincare sets featuring clean, vegan, cruelty-free products that are safe for your skin and the planet. Osea is a women-founded, women-led brand that's been making seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. This Mother's Day, Osea has 2 limited edition sets, perfect for gifting or keeping for yourself. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for silky, smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set has everything she needs to achieve spa-level results at home. They're so beautiful, you can skip the wrapping. For a limited time, you can save up to $48 on Osea sets, plus get free shipping. That's Mother's Day made easy. Pamper the moms in your life and get 10% off your first order site-wide with code MOM at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code MOM.